There I go.
All right, and then it doesn't show. We don't get the notice because we already got the notice. All right, we're recording. It is December 23rd, 2025. And so we're our last two sessions of this year. During this time, we sit for 20 minutes or so, and then I'll talk for a while, and usually there's some time for questions at the end. And nothing much else to report. I did teach on Sunday, so on Spirit Rock, and that was really quite delightful. Really enjoyed it. It felt like a real community of people, and I know there's a few people here who maybe would have liked to have been there. And they did record just my talk, so I just had them record the talks. At least one of them was, I think both talks were actually reasonably, not that I like to, judge myself, but as those who hang out with me, regularly know, my talks can get a little drifty and digressive, but I kind of stayed on topic, and I think they came out fairly well. The first talk was, one I kind of give every year, which is keep coming back. It works if you work it. So work it because you're worth it. So those are the main, that's the outline of the talk, and it, which is, really a fun sort of way to work through a talk because it really, it actually touches on a lot of Dharma as well as a lot of recovery. So that talk should be on a Dharma seed. It might actually be there already. The audio guy said he was uploading it just at the end of the day. And then the second talk was on the five aggregates and a lot of focus on Vedana, which is kind of the theme that I've been covering here a lot lately. In any case, let us start today's session with some meditation. Just starting just by settling into a posture that's conducive to calming and yet maintaining some alertness and clarity. So that balance that we work with and could say seek. We seek to attain balance. However, even such an idea can be counterproductive, chasing after something. In any case, just finding a posture that works for you. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. I'm beginning just by feeling your body, feeling the energies and sensations in the body right now. And noting what your state of mind is right now, you're feeling like, what's going on for you. Sometimes simply stopping and closing our eyes brings something up, either like mentally a thought or something sort of energetically. I find it helpful not to enter a period of meditation with an idea of what we want to make happen or with some plan, but rather to start by just seeing what's present right now. a sense of openness, acceptance, even curiosity. And then bringing forward the breath or awareness of the breath. Breaking the breath into the two parts of the inhalation and exhalation. This makes the contrast clear, the sensations more clear. How strong is the pull of the mind away from the breath? Can you even get to the breath in the middle of our day when we try to stop and just be with this very simple experience? Can be a little tricky. If your mind has been busy already, it's not always going to just stop because you ask it to. So you might have to turn toward the resistance or the energy, the grasping. Not to analyze that or judge it, just to acknowledge it and to feel it. This will have a cognitive element, the words and thoughts, images in the mind, but also this energetic element that doesn't have words, just feeling the forward thrust. Here we can bring mindfulness. More difficult to be mindful of the thoughts, but the feelings can be sensed, felt, allowed, accepted. Then we use the breath to open the body and to calm the mind. our practice, just like our recovery, is to keep coming back. Keep returning to the breath. This, of course, means that the mind is wandering, or we wouldn't have to return. And our relationship to the busyness of the mind is central to this process. Try not to be bothered. Not to be bothered by the wandering mind, but the busy thinking going on. And at the same time, we persist in coming back gently, lovingly. Each time we return to the breath, we also return to the whole body. Have a sense of releasing once more. And with time, there's usually a gradual settling, not something we can control, but with persistence, the attention can finally becomes somewhat stabilized. All right. Well, I'm rarely at a loss for words, as people here know. And I can't say that I'm at a loss right now, but I don't have a strong sense of something I want to talk about necessarily. I was thinking I'll just ramble a little bit. I was on Sunday I took my guitar to the to Spirit Rock, and at the end of the day I played the Metta Sutta song that's on my Laughing Buddha album. Someone said they were like listening to that album, and then Spotify like took them to the Better Than Ezra, which is led by the guitar player Kevin Griffin. So and someone also, I don't know if it was, someone sent me a an AI inquiry they made about Kevin Griffin, and AI thinks that he and I are the same person. So it's like Kevin Griffin is a Buddhist teacher who records with a band called Better Than Ezra. It's like very. So they haven't quite got AI perfected. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I had been thinking about you know what I could play other than one of my own songs, and I recall my first Buddhist teacher. So I'll tell a story rather than a Dharma talk. My first Buddhist teacher was a monk who from Brooklyn, who had just returned from 8 years in Sri Lanka in the fall of 1980, and he was living at the International Buddhist Meditation Center in Los Angeles, kind of the Wilshire district, somewhere like that. His name was Akasa, and he Akasa was what my mother would have called a character. It was not long, maybe less than a year probably before he left the robes and got in a relationship, became a therapist, grew his hair really long. Last time I saw him, which wasn't that long ago, only about, maybe 20 years ago, he had this long hair. But anyway, at the time he was a monk, and he had a Vipassana class once a week, and they had a beautiful meditation hall there. It was kind of Zen style, and there were tatami mats and then sit on zafus, and we would sit kind of in lines, not like the Vipassana, just people in random places as we go. If you go to like my retreats, people are just all over the place, leaning against the wall in the back. And he would, at that time, I guess things weren't so sort of orderly in the way Dharma was presented. And he had been to IMS and sat with Jack and Joseph, I think, and Stephen Levine's work, and he kind of just used all the stuff that was popular then. In fact, instead of giving guided meditations, he would just set up a cassette machine with a recording of Stephen Levine and put it on and leave, and then come back in 45 minutes. And anyway, went to the retreat with him in Joshua Tree that fall, for Thanksgiving, and then he had a 3-day weekend retreat over President's Day in February of 1981. And he, in the middle of that retreat, like 2 days into just sitting in this, very austere setting and very rigorous, just sitting and walking. It wasn't any fooling around. Suddenly comes on his cassette machine, John Lennon singing, Watching the Wheels. And that was what I was thinking about on Sunday. Like, I didn't know that song. So yesterday I sat down and worked on it with my guitar. And this was, for those who know their, history, this was just, a couple months after he was murdered. And so it was, very poignant in that regard. But also, it really highlighted how that song was this Dharma song. I'm trying to find now. I had the lyrics up on my computer before, but now I'm not finding them. Hopefully, oh, here they are. So worth going through, if you don't mind. People say I'm crazy doing what I'm doing. They give me all kind of warnings to save me from ruin. When I say I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. Surely not, you're not happy now. You no longer play the game. And we can, we kind of sensed, as people who were familiar with obviously the Beatles, and that he had been sort of inactive for a long time. And then, he had just done this new album that previous fall, right before he was murdered. I sort of could hear what was coming here. So the second verse is, people say I'm lazy, dreaming my life away. Well, they give me all kinds of advice designed to enlighten me. When I tell them that I'm doing fine, watching shadows on the wall, don't you miss the big time, boy. You're no longer on the ball. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just had to let it go. And when you've been sitting for a couple of days, I mean, I knew the song, but it was like, what? And music, again, when you're really settled, it's one of the, it's just so penetrating. You feel it so much. It's so beautiful. And the when the mind state is so open. So he goes on. People asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solutions. Well, they shake their heads and they look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry. I'm just sitting here doing time. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just had to let it go. I just had to let it go. I just had to let it go. What a song, huh? And the in the sort of serious Buddhist worlds, like, oh, you don't play music during a silent retreat, you'll ruin it or something. It's like, no, actually, it can be a great opening and obviously hugely uplifting. I mean, the joy and the rapture that comes up when you're hearing that. And hearing the wisdom, obviously, that this guy had obviously had, I just had to let it go. I mean, he's using spiritual language. The words enlightenment is in there. And, it's clear that, I mean, that he'd been doing something more than TM. He'd been doing Zen practice from what I understand, but it doesn't matter. He didn't even, have to necessarily, I don't know that he was necessarily trying to, send out coded language. The just watching the shadows on the wall is that image from Plato's The Cave. Which I only know because Joseph Goldstein used to talk about it. I have not read Plato, sorry. Not to, the line, of course, one of the wonderful lines, I tell them there's no problem, only solutions, and this sort of, it's a classic also, I mean, as a songwriter and, a connoisseur of the Beatles, it's kind of a classic. John Lennon that he's having this conversation, right? It's not just that he's saying stuff. He's saying people are saying these things, and this is what I'm saying to them, you know. And obviously, you know, he's not quoting people, but obviously that he's going through this, like you can imagine. I mean, you're a Beatle, come on, you know. But it is really beautiful, and obviously, as a musician myself, I've always viewed music as a spiritual practice. When I say always, before I knew it was a spiritual practice, I knew it was a spiritual practice. You know, it was my gateway into life, into meaning, into happiness, and into healing as well. I find music incredibly healing. I was thinking about, oh, could I learn that song and play it maybe at a retreat sometime? And boy, of course, it's a piano song. So as a guitar player, it's like it doesn't really, a lot of the great parts in it don't quite translate onto the guitar. But anyway, that's a technical problem we can face in the future. I guess that kind of came up also because I just had to let it go and all that. And I'd been talking here and around about writing about depression lately, and I'm sort of deciding that I have to let that go because it's getting me too depressed to think, you know, when I write a book, it infiltrates my life, and that can really be a beautiful thing. I wrote a book about the Anapanasati Sutta a couple of years ago. It was not published, but it's on my website. And that's the Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. And while that was happening, I became more and more absorbed into that practice, not just in meditating, but in my daily life. And I've carried that forward. And you know, it sort of seems ridiculous for a Buddhist to say that they've gotten really into mindful breathing, you know, because I've been practicing for 45 years, and it was the first thing I learned. But it's quite interesting how deep you can go with that. Anyway, you know, as I was writing that, you know, I got very absorbed in that. And then when I was writing my book, Living Kindness, I got very absorbed into the loving kindness practices and connecting with that. And so, you know, okay, I'll write a book about dealing with depression. It's like, oh, after a couple months of trying to work on it, I'm just like getting totally terrible irritability and foggy mind and states I haven't had for several years, which is why I thought I could write about it. Right now I'm kind of letting it go. We shall see. You know, the editor is telling me how, you know, oh, people really, you know, people need this book. It's like, no, people can live without Kevin Griffin writing another book. Anyway, I told you I didn't have anything to say today, so this is what happens. Let's see. Oh, well, my neighbor is fooling around outside my window. Sorry. It is, you know, the holidays, so things are chaotic. Just for fun, since I have a few more minutes, I will share a little bit of the beginning of this book on Anapanasati. The Anapanasati Sutta, the Discourse on Mindfulness of Breathing, Majjhima Nikaya 118, is one of the most elegant teachings in early Buddhism. Its meditation instructions are both poetic and practical. Their logic draws us in and leads us inexorably to awakening. One feels the skilled, compassionate, and wise hand of the Buddha guiding you forward. Its form is simple, its teachings profound, and its challengings daunting. Thich Nhat Hanh says that when he first encountered the Sutta, he thought he'd, quote, discovered the greatest treasure in the world. The Buddha says that mindful breathing creates, quote, an ambrosial pleasant feeling. Great line, an ambrosial pleasant feeling. Like I've been drinking the drink of the gods, right? Ambrosia. The sutta contains five main sections, one laying out the setting in which it was given, a second considered the heart of the sutta, giving the meditation instructions, and three more detailing the fruits of the practice. The role of the sutta in Theravada and Buddhism has fluctuated over time, sometimes given prominence, sometimes submerged beneath more popular commentarial texts. In recent decades, there has been a revival of interest. What makes the sutta so appealing is that it promises to give us guidance on the most fundamental tool used in Buddhist meditation, mindful breathing. For me, what makes it even more interesting is that once engaged in a serious way, that promise becomes much more complicated. What at first seems straightforward and transparent becomes, in application, something of a puzzle. So, I like that introduction. I think it makes you want to read the book, I would say. So, in the spirit, oh yeah, there you go. I was going to say, put the link. So there you have. I have it on my website as a PDF. And what I did in this book was, I started writing about the sutta, and I said, I don't know enough about this. I'm not an expert on this. So I read Thich Nhat Hanh, who has two books on the Anapanasati Sutta, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who is a Theravada monk who was considered a master of this practice, Venerable Inalio, the contemporary translator who's a scholar of early Buddhism and a very advanced meditator. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi, whose talks on this on the topic, he has 4 hours worth of talks on it. And then actually the one more, Ajahn Pasano, who was the first inspiration to write about it. So there's 16 steps in the sutta, and what I do is I talk about my own experience with it, and I talk about how each of these different teachers refers to it. Because, and the reason I wanted to do that is because there's not agreement about what each of the steps means and what you're supposed to do, which is another reason why I didn't want to come out and say, well, this is what you should do. But I think, I think it's really interesting to kind of compare and contrast these real masters' views of this core Buddhist teaching, and then work with it yourself and see what happens. What do you come up with? At the end of the day, what I my final kind of takeaway with the sutta, and one of the reasons I have not. Well, I'll just say my final takeaway of it is that the 16-step process is not so much a prescription for how you should practice, but a description of what happens when you do practice very deeply mindfulness of breathing, that it's actually describing a natural unfolding process. It starts with mindfulness of the breath itself, the body, and then feelings and energetic states, and then mind states, and then the insights that come out of that. So, because it seems that the Buddha is just saying, well, do this and do this and do this and do this, and then you'll get here, And, that's a little too mechanical. I've never found, for me, meditation practice has never worked like that. It doesn't work in a mechanical way. It's the instructions always sound like that, which I think is one of the reasons why people get confused or frustrated when they're trying to become really good meditators, when they're trying to really learn how to meditate and they're like trying to go somewhere with it. It's like, well, this is what I'm supposed to do and this is what's supposed to happen. And I can't do that and it's not happening, you know? And so there's this kind of tension, right? Frustration, even certainly, I think for me, for quite some time, that it wasn't working the way it was supposed to, right? And then finally realizing, like, no, that's not really the meditation instructions. They're given in this way. Well, who knows why I can't speak for why the Buddha taught a particular way. But I would just say that it's really hard and almost doesn't make any sense to give vague, general, maybe this will work and who knows what'll happen kind of meditation instructions. You know, you kind of have to say, well, do this and do this and do this. And then I think just kind of trust that if people stick with it, they will figure it out. Because at the end of the day, I think that's what the main task of becoming a meditator is, figuring it out for yourself, because you're in your mind, and not only can nobody. Can we not really describe the mind? But we can't get inside anyone's mind. And so everybody's kind of thrown into the deep end of the pool on their own. They just have to, they use the meditation instructions as the, little raft to hang on to. But that's not. You're the one who has to figure out how to swim in there to, use a metaphor. So there you go. I got somewhere. I had to bumble around a little bit to get to some kind of a Dharma teaching, but there you go. And I kind of watch the clock, and if I can get to like 10:50, then I figure I've given enough of a teaching. So, I don't get paid by the hour exactly, but I pay myself by the hour. So I'll leave it at that and see if there's any comments or questions anybody has here. And I really do hope people will read my Anapanasati book. I have no way of knowing how many people have downloaded it, and and it's free, so there's that. Bill.
Hey Kevin, good to see you the other day too. It was interesting when you were reading the lyrics from Lennon's song,
Yeah.
Watching the Wheels, and there's a line in there, Lost in Confusion.
Yeah.
And it reminded me because I was a real Love, the band Love that came out of LA back in the early 70s,
Oh,
late 60s.
yeah. One of my favorites.
Arthur Lee, and he does that song and more again. And
Yeah.
one of his Arthur Lee's lyrics was also Lost in Confusions.
Oh,
As a musician, do you feel like you're lost in confusions also, Kevin? That's
As a mu I, as a musician, I'm less lost in confusion as I am just a human being, I'll say.
Okay.
I have a good idea. About music.
Just messing with you. Thanks,
Well,
Kevin.
Forever Changes is,
God.
I think, one of the best albums. It's definitely in the top three albums ever, and
It's really a good one, yeah.
it's really an amazing.
Yeah.
There's a just digress a little bit. He came back. He did a concert. Did you ever see
Yeah,
that
in
live
Europe.
show? Yeah, I think it's at
There was
the
that
big.
place in England or
Yeah, blah
Scotland or
blah.
something.
That summer concert they always have.
starts with a G. I can't think of it. It's G.
Right, Glastonbury.
That's it. That's
Yeah, that's right. So he did the whole thing with,
he
and
did.
he
And he
got a
was,
band to like play all the parts and everything.
yeah,
It's,
and he was sick at that time.
yeah, he was about ready to go. Yeah,
Anyway,
Arthur Lee, very
yeah,
good
he was sick.
reference, Bill.
All right. Take care of yourself. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks, man. Forrest, hi.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, thank you for sharing, and Monica as well, putting up there your Anapana Sutra book. I just downloaded it. I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Good.
Yeah, but I gotta, your first part of your talk today, it kind of strung a chord with me, and something I've pondered in my own sobriety quite a bit. And I'm a little younger than most of the people here, but I'm in age. Not that much younger, but a little
Watch
bit.
that.
But really, my firsthand experience, I was born in 68. I was probably
Yeah, you are a puppy.
created in the summer of love, so I didn't
Right,
have first.
right. Very good.
I do, but still, much of the soundtrack in my youth was from the 70s. And then, I really hit my stride in the 80s. I graduated high school in 86.
Yeah.
And certainly,
Wow.
music produced in that era was profound to me.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, a lot of the, was my understanding, some of you might know more of what John Lennon's consciousness state was at the time that he wrote this, but I was under the understanding he was, a heroin addict at that time.
No, I think he had quit heroin. That's kind of how,
Well, that's a beautiful thing to hear, because
yeah. No,
I've often
he was
found that a
clean.
lot of those musicians of that era, that I often, that old line of who do you like better, the Beatles or Stone? I said it to a group of kids one time as a conversation starter, and they replied, before or after the Beatles started doing drugs. And I have to confess that, especially after they did started do it, introduced to LSD, their music was so much more profound and meaningful for me. And even then, I really, there's no doubt that as an adolescent and a young adult, LSD and the Grateful Dead were a huge part of my experience, for better or worse, have had a long-term effect on how I experience and view the world. And
Yeah.
certain some of Garcia's and Hunter Garcia's lyrics,
Yeah.
whether Ripple or Eyes of the World, there's these beautiful nuggets of a beauty and insight into them. And I always kind of still love, enjoy listening to a lot of that music. And I also confess, as one of those musicians got sober, their music just didn't seem to have the same beauty and insight for me. And I've always kind of pondered something I've pondered over time. I
Yeah,
don't
well, I can see we're going to go down a very
know.
deep rabbit hole here if we continue on this top theme. So, but thank you. I do think I think that music, I mean, art, just generally, artists, art is a inherently spiritual undertaking and expression, and artists connect in a way that's very deep. And, that doesn't mean that their personal lives are not flawed and oftentimes deeply flawed. And we don't have to get into that whole story. But yeah. And of course, for me, music, I mean, there's a lot of silly pop songs that have wisdom in them. And you realize that the people who wrote them knew things, but were not living those things. And that's the big difference about recovery. That's beautiful about recovery, that we're able to actually try to live out these spiritual principles in all our affairs, I might say. It's not just words on a page or something we're singing, but it's something we're trying to live, and so that's the challenge, right? And the tragedy, really, and the, what we when we view these great artists who we know have insight and wisdom, but don't have the I don't know, get a discipline, or they haven't found sila, let's just say. Anyway, any other thoughts? Anybody want to take us in any direction? They pretty much, so this is the Christmas edition of the Zoom class, so whatever presents you want to give. I was since I don't see a hand up, I'll just recollect my dear friend, and some of you know Wes Nisker, and he loved the solstice, and he would certain holidays were like Wes's holidays, so he would always give a talk at this time of year on that, and that April Fool's was probably his other favorite, but maybe Halloween, Anyway, I always think of him this time of year, and also my mother, who was born on December 21st. So it's got a lot of, I think a lot of us have feelings around this time of year, right? The losses and the memories and all that. So Gabrielle, please speak.
Thank you. Two things quickly, although I could go on because I've been thinking a lot lately, but not when I'm meditating.
Oh, good for you.
I was on a cruise to, well, I knew Wes Nisker when I lived in the Bay Area when he used to be at KSAN and Famous Scoop and all of that sort of stuff. So that was cool. I didn't know him, but I knew of him. And then about 5 or 7 years ago, we were on a trip to Patagonia, and he was on my boat.
Oh, wow.
So we hung out really a lot, and
Oh.
it was really, really great. And
Wow, I didn't know he did that.
he did. He went with a guy named Jeff Green, something like
He was his best friend.
travel agency or something like that. Yeah.
Well, he was a travel writer too, so
Exactly. Yeah.
yeah.
So he was there with him. Anyway, it was wonderful. So I've been meditating for around 25 years, and I think so much of it was I didn't ever get anywhere. But I would keep doing it
But
because doing it was better than not doing it as far as helping my sobriety and everything, even though I didn't know about you and I didn't know about Buddhist recovery or anything. It was just a some sort of a support that made itself present in my life. Lately, just for no reason that I understand, I've just got this equanimity that's just coming to me, and all of a sudden, I feel this, I'm happy for no reason, and feel very kind of calm, and I'm going on after all this time, my first noble silent meditation retreat for a week on Saturday through the new year, and just
Excellent.
really excited about it. But last week I had been in Italy with some girlfriends for 10 days in Florence. It was also just amazing. And I just saw the fruit of my practice like I'd never seen it before. And I'm trying, Joko Beck says, you've got to be really careful when things are going good.
Yes.
Not to cling and not to attach and not to feel, oh, I'm doing so well and everything. But I don't know, I don't really know how to balance that with actually feeling good and feeling happy I've gotten there and everything. Anyway, as you can see, I'm kind of rambling, but I'll
No,
leave
not at all.
it. Just really, really grateful for this group and for everything that you're doing for us, and happy holidays to
Yeah,
everybody.
thank you. I mean, that's great, Gabrielle. First of all, it's lovely when the practice starts to kind of work, when you start to feel it working. You might want to go see the doctor just in case something's gone wrong. But really, no, seriously, well, first of all, it is tricky to just enjoy sitting and let go of thinking that the pleasantness means something. It's just like the unpleasantness. It's just what you're experiencing, and certainly, if you can be mindful of how that feels, that tends to be a very wholesome state. That certainly the Buddha talks about joy as one of the factors of awakening. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, step five, breathing in, experiencing joy, breathing out, experiencing joy. Step six, breathing in, experiencing happiness, breathing out, experiencing happiness. It's part of the practice. It's not meant, you're not meant to be miserable. And you go on a retreat and anything can happen. Might be pleasant, might be unpleasant, might be boring, might be maddening, might be joyful, might be more likely all of the above. And so it definitely takes patience, but I admire and I'm pleased to hear, you're just saying that you've just kept doing it, because that to me is the essence of it. That's the keep coming back. There are ups and downs, and there are things that happen, and things keep changing and unfolding, and it's wonderful and not wonderful and boring, and it's all those things, but it's just continuing to show up. And like I said on Sunday, like what keeps me going is a certain amount of faith. Especially in the beginning, when nothing was happening, when it was just brutal to meditate, and physically painful, and it was just like I believed in this practice, and a certain amount of that just faith. I don't know if I call it blind faith, but it's, faith, just, it's somewhat almost delusional. You have no idea what's going on, but. But it's good because it's leading you in the right direction. So that's great. I would love to hear how your retreat goes. Please give us a report when you come back. So don't drink or use no matter what, particularly over these next 10 days, everybody. This is a high risk time of year, and it's a good time to connect with community and those who you love, who will also support you, because you may love people who don't support you or whatever, don't make it easier for your life easier. So wishing everybody well, and I will be back presumably next Tuesday, which should be what, December 30th, so it'll be almost New Year's. So, peace,
Thank you,
blessings.
Kevin. Thank you,
Yeah.
Kevin. Merry Christmas
Thanks,
to you and your
guys.
family.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Kevin.
Kevin.
Take care, Kevin.
Nice to see everybody.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Kev.
Thanks. John, nice to see you.